Let's start with a prayer, and then we'll jump into our discussion of this. Our God in heaven, we are blessed to have this copy of your word that we can read in our own language and understand, and so we can know how David was helped by you and how he responded to your grace and how we might respond in a similar way. Thank you for saving your people. Thank you for this record of brave deeds done for the king so that we might imitate their courage and their faithfulness and their love for the Anointed One. Be with us in our discussion, and may we be encouraged and strengthened and helped. In the name of Jesus we pray. Amen. Amen. All right, 2 Samuel 22. We're almost here at the end of 2 Samuel. Come Hebrews, we'll just be doing a chapter each week. So if come October you go, we don't have a study guide, don't know what's coming, it's going to be a chapter a week. Different men will be sharing responsibilities and teaching that. They may send out a study guide, so be watching your emails for that. If I don't have your email address, and I will make sure that that gets to you. But for now, 2 Samuel 22 and 23. Verse 1 says, David spoke to the Lord the words of this song on the day when the Lord delivered him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. Now, this song is found in another place in the scriptures. Where? What was it? The Psalms. Yes, it is found in the Psalms and Psalm 18. Is that right? Oh, wait. Did I say? Never mind. That's on the question number one. I was going to be impressed with people who got it. But question number one, 2 Samuel 22 is also recorded for us as Psalm 18. Right. Take your time to read and reread this song carefully. I'm sure everyone did that. All right. Great. Except for me, because I didn't obviously read my own question. Let's take the time to read this. It's a long song. In fact, remember, the book of Psalms is divided into five books. And so Psalm 18 is in the first book. And it is, I think, the longest psalm by twice as much in book one. It is twice as long as any other psalm in book one of the Psalms. So it's just an impressive moment in David's life for him to look back at what God has done. But we'll talk about that in a second. Let's go ahead and read through this and then answer some questions. Let's get a volunteer to read this beginning in verse 2 down through the end. Volunteer to Juliana, you were looking at me. You know. All right, would you read verses 2 through 51, please?
According to my righteousness, according to my cleanness in his eyes. yourself merciful. With a blameless man, you will show yourself blameless. With the pure, you will show yourself pure. And with the devious, you will show yourself true. You will save the humble people, but your eyes are on the haughty, that you may bring them down. For you are my lamp, O Lord. The Lord shall enlighten my darkness. For by you I can run against the truth. By my God I can leap over a wall. As for God, his way is perfect. The word of the Lord is proven. He is a shield to all who trust him. Who is God except the Lord, and who is a rock except our God? God is my strength and my power, and he makes my way perfect. He makes my feet like the feet of the deer, and he sets me on my high places. He teaches my hands to make war, so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze. You have also given me the shield of your salvation. Your gentleness has made me great. You enlarged my path under me, so my feet did not slip. I have pursued my enemies and destroyed them. Neither did I turn back again until they were destroyed. And I have destroyed them and wounded them so that they could not rise. They have fallen under my feet. For you have armed me with the strength for battle. You have subdued under me those who rose against me. You have also given me the necks of my enemies so that I destroyed those who defeated me. They looked, but there was none to save. Even to the Lord, he did not answer them. Then I beat them as fine as the dust of the earth. I trod them like dirt in the streets, and I spread them out. You have also delivered me from the strivings of my people. You have kept me as the head of the nations. A people I have not known shall serve me. The foreigners submit to me. As soon as they hear, they obey me. The foreigners fade away, and they come frightened from their hideouts. The Lord lives. Blessed be my rock. Let God be exalted, the rock of my salvation. It is God who avenges me and subdues the peoples under me. He delivers me from my enemies. You also lift me up above those who rise against me. You have delivered me from the violent man. Therefore, I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the Gentiles, and sing praise to your name. He is the tower of salvation to his king, and gives mercy to his anointed, to David and his descendants evermore.
Excellent. You deserve a drink of water after that. Thank you. I meant to ask not to put away the song books, but we did. So this song in 2 Samuel 22, also Psalm 18, we often sing this song, but there's a lot going on here. Can you think of any songs that we sing that connect back to this one? That's a bad question. What songs do we sing connect back to this one? Amos?
The Rock of My Heart.
That one does connect to this one, but it connects to another psalm better. The rock. This one mentions rock a lot. You might remember the Rock of My Heart is actually Psalm 73 is the Rock of My Heart. There's another one. Justin?
I will call upon the Lord.
Yes. I will call upon the Lord. That is from this psalm, okay? Yeah, and then there's some others that connect here. But this is just is such a powerful cry of salvation. You know, God has delivered me. So there's so much going on here. But this is, it's strange too. It's a really strange song. So ask the question, how is God described in these verses? We've got rock already. Amos mentioned the rock. Amos? Jordan? I looked, and yeah, Jordan? Okay, yes, for example. Good, yeah, the Lord is pure to those who, he's merciful to those who are merciful, verse 26 and 27. I hadn't thought about the Beatitudes when I was reading this, but that's exactly what this is, right? Blessed are the merciful, blessed are the pure, so that's there. Amos, you had another one.
Well, he's shown as very powerful and being David's salvation.
Okay, for example, give me some verses here.
Well, it basically verses 8 through 16.
Okay, good. Yeah, the power of God is really present there. Lynn?
I'm just thinking about how he is simultaneously describing God from the beginning as this safe place, as this stronghold, as this fortress, as this shield. But then in the next section, he's talking about like a God who bows the heavens and comes down, and there's smoke and there's
yes.
Like mighty water, and it's very terrifying.
Yes, yeah, yeah. By the way, does David repeat himself at all in this psalm?
Well, the characteristics of the writing, the genre, allows for that.
Yeah.
Where there's a lot of reprint. In different ways, but
yeah, he's emphasizing this. This word gets used again and again, and then later again, and then shows up again. It's almost like a chorus. We sing a chorus multiple times, and it does put me in mind. Remember when Jesus he taught us to pray in the Sermon on the Mount? He talks about vain repetitions. It's not that we can't repeat ourselves in prayer. David repeats himself here in this song. The idea is that we think we'll be heard because we'll get the words just right. David is just expressing what he's feeling. And this is who God is. He's a refuge. What is he? He's a refuge. He's a stronghold. He's a fortress. He's also a refuge. Did you know he's a refuge? He's a refuge. He just keeps on saying the same thing again and again because that's an expression of what he's feeling. It's not vain. It is true. What else? What are some other descriptions of God here? Alex?
I like in verse 3 how he talks about him being a horn of salvation.
What does that mean?
That, like, you blow the trumpet and it's just the sound of salvation.
Yeah, the shofar, right? And I don't know which way this goes. And this could be, horn of salvation could be something you blow, but it could also be what else?
Like a ram's horn.
Yes, yeah, so this strong ox or ram is going to come in and burst through the forces. And so God is very much like that. But it could also be the horn, because take that horn and you blow into it. And is that David calling for reinforcements? Or is that here he's stuck in battle and then he hears reinforcements coming and they're blowing the horn? I think I may have mentioned Lord of the Rings last week, maybe. I'm not even sure. But you remember in Two Towers, have you seen? Anyway, just imagine you're in battle, okay? And then you hear... It's like, oh yes, we've got someone coming. And that's David. When he sees God show up, it's like reinforcements have shown up. It's like the horn has been blown. So whether David's blowing it or God is blowing it, that's really powerful. What else?
Deliverer.
He's my deliverer. And the way David thinks through this, he's not just the deliverer of Israel. He's my deliverer.
And he said it in verse 17.
Yes, in fact, look at 17 through 20. He sent from on high, he took me, drew me, he rescued me from those who hated me. They were too mighty for me, confronted me in the day of my calamity. The Lord was my support. I mean, David just feels, this is not a self-absorbed moment. This is overwhelmed that God cares so much for me. He's my personal deliverer. Donnie?
I was thinking from 6 to 9, or even further on, 11, it described the dread. Or the terror of God.
Yeah.
So David knows the one who protects, the one who can bring him salvation,
yes,
is also a dreadful God.
Yes. And let's go ahead and talk about that. Unless there was, I saw some other hands going up. Dwight, you had a thought.
It was a similar answer to the deliverance, and at the end it says, great deliverance.
Yes. Yes, yeah, the end here, this is an invitation for everyone to come and find deliverance from God. So he delivered me, he'll deliver you too if you call on him. That's the point of worship, is let's join in with this song of praise because he can deliver you. But let's talk about God the smoke monster for a moment. Because you read this and it's like, what's going on? Verse 9, smoke went up from his nostrils, divine fire from his mouth, glowing coals flaming forth from him. He's bowing the heavens down. It's like he's stepping out into the cosmic material universe, and it's just going, oh, and feeling the weight of God's glorious wrath as he's coming down to deliver David. Amos?
It seems that this is his anger against his enemies, and that this is supposed to be encouraging to David.
It is. It is. Imagine being on the playground as a little kid, and you're over here in a scuffle, and some kid's got you in a headlock, and they're making you eat dirt or something. And then you look over, and you see the gym coach or your dad, and they're sitting on the bench, and they turn and look at you, and they get up. And the look on their face, they look angry. Are they angry with you? They're angry with this punk kid who's got you in the dirt. Does that feel good? Yeah. Because you know somebody's about to get the business. I mean, this is not going to be good for your enemy. So this is a comfort. Do we like to picture God this way? Well, it depends. It depends on where you are in this. Does this remind you of anywhere else in the Bible where God is pictured in this really powerful way, and it's almost kind of scary or monstrous. Lee? Yes, excellent. Mount Sinai. We're going to come back to that. What else?
Revelation. Noah?
Did you say Revelation? Revelation. And who's pictured there?
Jesus.
That's Jesus. It's cosmic Jesus. And I mean, there's a sword coming out of his mouth. He's got feet that are like burnished bronze. I mean, this is scary, scary stuff. So it's not that this is meant to be grotesque, God in some monstrous form. It's meant to showcase his power to protect his people. Lynn?
Did you already mention Sinai?
Yes, Lee just mentioned Sinai.
Well,
yeah.
I'm also thinking about, like, and I checked it, there's in Psalm 144, which is one of David, there's also the time where he's calling for this. He's asking for God to come
yes.
out. He's asking for the smoke to come forth. Like,
yes.
they already knew this is what God could be like.
Yes.
And there are times that they ask for him to come down and deal judgment.
Right. Right. Noah?
He's riding on a cherub. Any idea how powerful a cherub is? I mean, he's just an incredible,
yeah.
powerful creature. He's riding like that.
Yeah. So remember, you've got, I don't think it was even a cherub, it was just an angel. 185,000 Assyrian soldiers, one night, right? We also see Ezekiel 1. There's some flavors of Ezekiel 1 here where he's got the cherubim and they're like lightning, and they've got the wheels and the faces and the feet. And God's just coming down in his glory on his majestic heavenly war chariot. That's kind of the picture. Amos?
Well, I was about to say Ezekiel, but also in Ezekiel, that's only an appearance of the likeness
right.
of the glory.
Right, the appearance of the likeness of the glory. It's not even what it actually is. It's just a hint of a hint of a hint of what God's glory is. No?
It almost sounds like a little kid trying to describe something awesome to a young. And also, he's like this, and there's lightning coming out, and
yes.
you almost get a sense of like this awesome, this.
Now here's,
you can't quite describe.
Here's the question. The passage tells us when this happened. When did this happen?
After God had saved him from the hand of Saul.
Yeah, so his enemies and from Saul. So tell me, where in 1 Samuel should I turn to read about God delivering David like this?
22.
In 1 Samuel 22? So I'll read about God showing up as a smoke monster in 1 Samuel 22. Yeah, David's fled there in 22. Saul comes, kills the priest at Nob. David goes and saves Keilah. They're going to turn him back over to Saul. Saul chases David. He meets him in a cave. Doesn't even know David's there. David doesn't kill Saul. Where is God showing up like this? Lee?
Isn't he everywhere up until 21? He says, and out of the hands of Saul.
Okay.
Well, they just had a revolution, remember?
Right.
Coup.
Yes.
Then the people from Israel said, no, we don't want David.
That's right.
They had to fight their fight.
That's right.
His enemies.
Yeah, so God is delivering him again and again and again and again. Mm-hmm. Alex?
This is at the end, he's writing this at the end of his life, so it sounds like he's saying, throughout my whole life, God has been saving me and saving me and saving me and helping me, and he's just the being that I need to go back to.
Yes.
And providing an example.
Yes.
For the others to trust him. And
this is kind of question two on the study guide. How does what God does in 2 Samuel 22, I beg your pardon, compare with what we read in 1 and 2 Samuel? When does God miraculously show up and save David? Elijah?
Saul's about to find him. Saul hears, oh, the Philistines are attacking.
There's a rumor.
Imagine that.
And the rumor is what spares David on that occasion. He's going around this side of the mountain, and then David's on this side of the mountain, and Saul's going to get him. He's going to get him. And the way God shows up riding out on a cherub is he sends a rumor out. Do you see what David's doing here? He is attributing the mundane, everyday, ordinary sorts of things to a glorious God. And he's not afraid to give God the credit for these ordinary moments of salvation. I think that's something that I I need to do better about. David's worship of God is great because God is great. But you look at what David has gone through. I mean, you might say there are some miracles here and there, but relatively few in David's life. And he slings a stone at Goliath. I would argue that probably wasn't miraculous. I think David probably, right in, he's dead. But maybe God helps him there. Who knows? But really, nothing just grandiose and wow, and God showed up, and not like Samson, it's just... This is just David being David, but God was with him. And David gives credit to God. And so he sees God as showing up in this powerful, powerful way. So there's a spiritual reality that David is recognizing through his everyday. Jordan? I think you're exactly right. Let's take it a step further. Even when we can say, look what I did, what does David say about what he did?
He gives
glory to God. Look at 2 Samuel 22 and verse 34. He made my feet like the feet of a deer. He set me secure on the heights. He trains my hands for war so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze. You have given me the shield of your salvation. Your gentleness made me great. I want to come back to that verse in a moment. But David doesn't think he's out here doing this on his own. He could boast in himself, but he doesn't. Right? Noah.
I think this is one prime example of where we see David having a heart after God's own heart.
Yes.
Being a man after God's own heart. Because he perceives how God is working.
Right.
Whereas Saul, I don't think really good.
Yeah. And you see the kind of courage it gives someone to know that God is working with this, the kind of boldness and the kind of humility. There's some tension in this song actually about that, and we'll touch on that in a moment. But yet, David sees God in his magnificence, and he rightly credits him with his salvation. Amos?
Well, it's a little confusing to me. Like in verses 21 through 25, and in other verses, he seems to be talking more about himself.
Okay.
Like in verse 38, in verse 43, it doesn't really make sense.
Yeah, so there's some of this, again, there's some tension here. So if Nathan were to come up to me and say, the Lord dealt with me according to my righteousness, I'd go, listen, brother. let's humble ourselves, please. We would not feel too great about this. Or if I said to Justin, all God's rules are before me, and from his statutes I have not turned aside.
It's a little bit boastful.
But we can't take this out of context, right? Go ahead, Shelby.
It seems like 21 and onward connects with verse 20. He says, he rescued me because he delighted in me. And he's saying, here's why.
Yes.
The Lord found me delightful. I followed his ways. I kept
his
ways.
Yeah. In fact, look at verse 42. These are the enemies of David. They looked, but there was none to save. They cried to the Lord, but he did not answer them. Doesn't God answer those who cry to him? Well, it depends, doesn't it? Are these people who have a relationship with God? And how do you prove that you have a relationship with God? You act righteously. You do what he tells you to do. So David has received God's mercy. He's received blessings from God. And really what we're seeing here is a response to God's rules. In verse 23, God taught him how to do this. God gave him instruction. He's rewarded me according to my righteousness. How did he know how to be righteous in the first place? God told him how. So what we see is an obedient servant crying out to God for help, and God shows up. And others are not obedient, and they cry to God for help, and God says, you're not my people, you're my enemy. In fact, there's a connection between David's enemies and God's enemies. These aren't his personal enemies only. These are David's enemies because they're God's enemies. Lindsay and then back to you.
I find this incredibly encouraging because we are not that far from having talked a lot about David's failures and sins and really bad things that he did. And so here we have to grapple with, like, what do you mean you said that you were righteous and that God is dealing with you in this way? And it's easy. When I was younger, I very much had the idea of, like, oh, well, righteousness is perfection.
Right.
Where righteousness is seeking to walk with the Lord.
Right.
You are in his righteousness.
Yeah.
And the idea that in verse 25, when he's like, according to my cleanness in his sight, we just have to go back to the Psalms where David is crying out, create in me a clean heart, O God. Where in this one snippet, it sounds like he's saying, like, oh, I'm so great. But we look everywhere else and we can see, no, he had all these failures and sins that he kept turning to God for rescue
right.
and cleaning from.
Right. There are some Bible passages in which the context demands we take righteous as being perfection. You know, there are none who are righteous, O Lord, none who are sinless. We all have forsaken God. We get that, Romans 3. But generally speaking, righteousness has to do with a relationship with God. It has to do with I obey his rules, I keep his commandments, but it's not a, God, I've done this, therefore you must.
Mm-hmm.
It's, God, you have given me mercy, and I'm responding to your mercy. And if you continue reading 26 and 27, again, with the merciful, you show yourself merciful. David's saying, I need mercy.
Mm-hmm.
I need your help. I've been pure, verse 27. You save a humble people. David's not saying, I deserve to be saved. He's saying God has made a commitment to save people who are in this relationship with him. And then 10, right?
Yeah. I was going to say for verse 21 to like 25, can we say that this psalm and other psalms, you know, just like she was saying, that, you know, David is always referring to God's salvation.
Yes.
And like asking for that mercy, God's righteousness, which gave to David. And so David can say, you know, the Lord.
Yeah, this is not saying, David's not saying, look, all I've done, God, I deserve your salvation. Again, he's crediting God with salvation. I'm stuck. I'm in a tight spot. Earlier, look at verse 5 and 6. The waves of death encompassed me, torrents of destruction, cords of the grave. I am stuck, God. I am caught, and I can't get out. And if you won't save me, I won't be saved. Amos.
I still don't really understand, like, verse 38 and 39, or in verse 43, when he says that I pursued my enemies and destroyed them, I consumed them, I beat them fine as the dust.
Yeah, you have to read 32 through 35 into that as well. I'm doing this because God equipped me, God gave me, God supplied me. And so he's the one who's trained me and taught me, made my feet like the feet of the deer. He's giving me strength. And so look at what we can do when God supplies. So David is not saying me. He's saying God through me.
Maybe okay. If you look at it from verse 35, I don't know what version you have, but it's in King James, it says, he teacheth my hands to war.
Right.
On that a bow of steel is broken by mine arms. Then he goes in to say that he is able to pursue his enemies. He's able to do this.
Go ahead, Noah. That's right. Yeah, Noah.
Segueing off of what you and Lindsay kind of said, I don't hear as much as he's saying, I am righteous. I almost more hear him saying, you know, I'm trying, God. I'm trying. And you are the one who's getting me there. There's a state that he is something, and state he's striving.
Right. As Michelle's pointed out, the whole point is that he is dependent on God. And so this is a song not celebrating what he has done, it's what God has done. All right, now, there's some details here we want to track on before we move on, because there's a lot we want to talk about in chapter 23 as well. For one, We mentioned this tight space that he's in earlier in 5 and 6. And in verse 7, where is God when he hears David? He's in his temple. Where's that? It's in heaven. Remember, in 1 Kings 8, Solomon is going to help to initiate the temple. He's going to consecrate the temple. And one thing he's going to pray about is that when people turn toward the temple, that God in heaven would hear. The temple has not been built on earth yet. And when we're looking at the chronology here, the temple's not been built. But David knows, and Solomon, even though he builds the temple, is going to know that God doesn't dwell in temples made with human hands. There is a heavenly dwelling, and God from heaven hears us. That's incredible. The fact that God in heaven hears me, this little me in my trouble. But there's this tightness of the space. When David is delivered, he sets him in a broad place, right? You see in verse 37, you gave a wide place for my steps under me, and my feet did not slip. And so the contrast is, I am stuck. How do I get unstuck? I pray to God. I cry out to God. And he delivers. He helps. Then we also mentioned verse 36. And verse 36, not only is God here the one we cry out to, but he also becomes a model for us. The kind of reign that David had as king, it has its troubles. But we've often made the comparison between David and Saul, that David was more compassionate, more patient, more gentle. And he says that it is your gentleness that made me great. There's a word we looked at in today's sermon that connects with that. Meek. It's meekness, isn't it? Meekness is the idea of having great strength but under control. And so here is God as this mighty figure who's dealing with David in a very gentle way. And I think sometimes we need to appreciate that when we raise children, being gentle with our children, and yet being firm. There's a firmness, there's a strength here. It's not gentleness because we're letting children walk all over us, but we're gently correcting. You know, we're gently tending to their needs. We're being consistent, we're demanding obedience, but there's a gentleness about this that encourages them. Titus makes the point that it's God's grace that leads us to self-control. How do we teach discipline? Through grace. It is a grace that teaches discipline. David, you look like you have a thought.
Just in my version it says, your answer has made me great.
Your answer has made me great. Okay. Other translations on verse 36? Lee, your help has made me great.
As I studied this, his mercy made David great.
Sure. Yeah.
But David has issues in his life. This takes us back to the righteousness of God. David wasn't particularly righteous. A good dude, but righteous. I don't know if I would apply righteous to David.
Well, in the way that Lindsay's helping us think through it, David was righteous. Well, he was righteous. He was a good man, a godly man. He obeyed God. What's recorded for us are several major blunders. And then if we were to edit the reel, we'd say, wow, look at that wicked man, David. But throughout his life, he's a faithful man. He's crying out to God. He's repenting when he's caught in sin.
Yeah. God is merciful.
God is merciful. God is merciful. One more thing before we move on to chapter 23. Look at verse 50 and 51. For this I will praise you, O Lord, among the nations, and sing praises to your name. Great salvation he brings to his king, and shows steadfast love to his anointed, to David and his offspring forever. Who is saying this?
David.
It's David,
right?
Seems
that he's speaking in second person.
Yeah. To David and his offspring forever. Okay, yeah, it's interesting. Speaking in third person about himself. But this is quoted in the New Testament. And so we hear it from the mouth of who in the New Testament? Jesus, Romans 15. And so who is the nations? That'd be us. Yeah, we're the nations, okay? And then the offspring of David? That'd be us too, right? You know, I mean, it could be Jesus, the offspring. He's the offspring, but he's also the anointed one. And so we become like children of the Christ. You know, we were anointed one as Christ. And so Romans 15 is making the point that we are the nations, we're the Gentiles who were invited to worship God because God's salvation is so great that it's not just David, it's not just Jesus, it's not just the Jewish people, it's all who trust in God for salvation. In fact, David is saying this because it's not just his personal experience. We mentioned Mount Sinai earlier. Did you notice in 15 and 16, what does this remind you of? He sent out arrows, scattered them lightning, and rooted them. And then the channels of the sea were seen. On the mountain, the lightning from the mountain, but what about the channels of the sea being seen? Yes, that's exactly right. And so David is looking back at what God did for a nation, for Israel, for the Exodus. And he says, what God did for them, he did for me. And then it's making the way for Jesus later, who really encompasses all of this and provides salvation for everyone. So this is all part of this thread and the story that we cry out to God for salvation. He's answered us by coming down. How did he come down? In gentleness and meekness, kindness, and died for us. And so, you know, this is really interesting to think about how God equips his people for war, spiritual war in our case, but how he also gave his son to save us. So a lot of layers in this one. Other thoughts through 2 Samuel 22 before we look in 23? Ithan. Right, yeah, 21 to 25. Yeah, I think that is part of this here. And like Lindsay said, this is placed here at the end kind of as a summary of David's life. And so it's an encouraging summary. But I would still say 21 through 25, yes, we can look at sins in David's life. But generally speaking, David's a righteous man. In the New Testament, he's called a godly man. He's a faithful man. So generally speaking, David is righteous. He calls out to God, and he has a kind of relationship where God hears him. In fact, we're going to see that later in 24, even when he has this relationship with God that he depends on. So you're right that in poetry and these songs, sometimes chronology doesn't matter. It just doesn't. But here, I think we're still looking at, for example, you go back in the time when David is being saved from Saul. David made some mistakes back there too. Right, he goes and eats the bread, the holy bread he has no right to, takes Goliath's sword, which wasn't wrong, but it shows he's trusting in his own strength rather than trusting in God's. So those pieces are still there.
Can we agree, though, that David repented, and that's kind of what
yes.
gave him some of his righteousness?
Absolutely. Now let's look at 23. These are the last words of David, the oracle of David, the son of Jesse, the oracle of the man who was raised on high, the anointed of the God of Jacob, the sweet psalmist of Israel. The Spirit of the Lord speaks by me, his word is on my tongue. The God of Israel has spoken, the Rock of Israel has said to me, when one rules justly over men, ruling in the fear of God, he dawns on them like the morning light, like the sun shining forth on a cloudless morning, like rain that makes grass to sprout from the earth. For does not my house stand so with God? For he has made with me an everlasting covenant, ordered in all things and secure. For will he not cause to prosper all my help and my desire? But worthless men are all like thorns that are thrown away, for they cannot be taken with the hand. But the man who touches them arms himself with iron and the shaft of a spear, and they are utterly consumed with fire. There's kind of a warning to future kings in this, an instruction they need to rule justly. One point to make here, though, is that David is saying, I'm speaking as by inspiration, verse 2. In 2 Chronicles 29, verse 25, later Hezekiah is going to be tasked with cleansing the temple and reordering things according to the right God-given structure. And it mentions that it was according to the command of David, as God had given it to David. So what David is writing here, what David is doing in helping to order worship for the temple, that's inspired of God. So that's just a point of reference here. Now, we're going to keep moving here and talk about David's mighty men because we've got 5 minutes.
I wanted to take like 15 minutes by this point.
All right, David's mighty men. When you think of the mighty men, what comes to mind?
Sons of Zariah.
Sons of Zariah. Okay. Jordan?
Benaiah the hitman.
Benaiah the hitman, yeah, that's right. Emma? Mighty men. Think of mighty men, what comes to mind? Yes, yeah. So these are the stories that like little Jewish boys would tell each other and be like, let's go in the forest and play David's mighty men. It's like, I want to be the guy who kills the lion in the snowy pit. I want to be the guy who takes the Egyptian out. I want to be one of the sons of Zer. And so, you know, man, I'm giving them a whiny voice and I shouldn't. But you know, these are the stories of their heroes, right? And they're given to us for a reason. But let's first talk about these stories. First of all, in verse 8, you've got Joshua Bashabeth, who wielded a spear against 800, whom he killed at one time. Amos?
Who is the three that is talked about?
Well, these are the three. Joshua Bashabeth is one of the three, and you're going to have Eleazar, the son of Dodo, and then you're going to have Shammah in verse 11. These are the three. Okay. The next of the three, you've got Eleazar. What is Eleazar known for doing?
Killed the Philistines, and he got stuff on
his hand. He's my favorite. because Eleazar, everyone else, they flee. And he stands and defends against these Philistines who come for battle. And he fights so long and so hard that what happens to his hand? It just cramps up and freezes to his sword. So when the battle is done and he's just weary and haggard and he just, and they come back to him and like, Eleazar, are you okay? And they're just dead Philistine bodies everywhere. And he's defending God's people. They have to like help him gently remove the sword from his hand because it's just frozen. We are weak sissy people. Like, these are people who said, I am going to fight because it's what's right, and you're not going to stop me. I'm not going to lose because God is with me, and I am just not going to quit. And it doesn't matter what danger is coming, I am going to fight. And he doesn't let go. The kind of mental ferociousness that's present with these men, it's incredible. The third guy, Shammah. There's a little field of beans, and he said, nope, my people need to eat. And so he defends that against the Philistines and defends it and strikes down the Philistines that come there. What needs to be done to take care of God's people? He fights. And so here you have these three men. And now there's this story about all three of them together. And what happens is the Philistines have taken this area around Bethlehem. And David's thirsty. And David, what connection does he have with Bethlehem?
That's his hometown.
This is where he grew up. He's born in Bethlehem. He grows up there. And so he says, oh, that I could have a drink from that well in Bethlehem. I don't think this is a hint. I think David is just feeling kind of nostalgic. And he's thirsty, and that was good water. And these three guys hear it, and they go. And they sneak out. And those three men break through Philistine forces. And just imagine, this would have been such a cool episode in the miniseries of David's life, right? Because this is when they break through, and this is either secret forces, right? I don't know if this is in the middle of the night, but they break in, and two guys are holding off the guard. The other guy's, you know, lowering the water, and he's going to bring it back up and fill up a water skin, and they haul it back. They got to break through again to get back to David, and they finally get to David, and David says, where did this come from? Well, you said you wanted water from the well at Bethlehem. What does David do with it? On one hand, you go like, well, we just got the water for you. But this was an honor to them. What they had brought, David saw as worthy only for God to receive. It was their lifeblood. Right? They had risked their lives to bring this to David. David says, no man is worth that. You see a lot of self-awareness from David. David doesn't go, yes, I'm king. That's right. Thank you. He says, God deserves your lives. And so he pours it out for God. What is it that drove those men to go get that water?
Service to the God's anointed.
They're serving the anointed.
They love for David.
They love David. Did David tell them to get water?
No.
He didn't have to. You ever caught yourself in this cycle or this scenario where you say, well, God didn't say I had to? Or, it's not a sin. I know it would please God. What if God said, you know what would make me really happy is if you met together once a week with other Christians and you remember my son Jesus? And we said, do I have to? And he says, well, no, you don't have to. I'm not telling you you have to, but it'd be really good for you to do. And I would like that if you thought about doing it. Or what if he didn't even just tell us he liked it? He just said, I love my son. He's worthy of praise. And we said, but it's not a sin if you don't go to worship on Sundays. Or there's other things that we know are morally questionable. And if you were to picture Jesus sitting in the back seat with you, how would you feel if he watched you do this? And you go, well, it's not a sin. But we can think, but would he be pleased with it? Do I love him so much that like these men, I'm going to fight through enemy lines in order to bring back an offering that's worthy of my king? These men put me to shame. We say, well, do I have to? Do I have to talk to my neighbors and my coworkers about Jesus? Do I have to give and be generous? Do I have to seek reconciliation with this friend? Do I have to? Do I want to do what's pleasing to the Lord? And Jesus doesn't even have to tell us. We just see that it delights him, and I'm eager to do it. No?
I think that's the crux of the difference between the new way Jesus brings in and the old way of the Old Testament.
Yes, but I'll say this too. These men, their love for their king in the Old Testament in some ways puts my love for my king in the New Testament to shame.
What I find most interesting is these were the same guys that dispirited the poor, the people had no land. They came to David and the Lord came initially.
Yeah.
And God transformed them.
Yes.
Into mighty men.
Yeah, these were the despised, the distraught, the distressed. Yeah, they come to David. And look what their love for the king's, for the Lord's anointed does for them. Right?
What I'm just thinking to go along with that is also they didn't look at the odds. They just went, this is what needs to be done.
Yeah.
This is what I should do. And they didn't sit there and go, is it really reasonable that I could kill 800 men by myself? Like, they just said, this is what I need to do. Whether it seemed impossible or not, and I think too often we can have small faith and we can say like, oh, maybe,
but he makes
as long as it goes well for me, but there are things that look at insurmountable to us. It seems impossible for us to be reconciled with somebody else. It seems impossible.
We need to go back to 2 Samuel 22 and read where he trains my hands for war by his strength, I can bend a bow of bronze. He's given me the shield. So if I'm depending on my own strength, yeah, I'll get to a point where I can't go any further. But I will feel stuck. Because I've been resting in my strength. And if I love the Lord and I've had a habit of leaning on him, I'll get to those moments and say, Lord, if you want this done, I'm here. And go do it. Amos?
Also, in a way, this is, I guess, a picture of Jesus. We didn't even want him to, but he brought us everlasting water.
Yes, I haven't seen that connection. Good. All right, there's more to be said about the mighty men. We could spend a whole class on the mighty men. We don't talk about these guys enough. But their love for the king is what's really, really impressive. David? Yes. Yeah. That's really the point, is we love them so much because of their love for the king. And it's that we want to transfer and think about, where do I measure up? Would I have been one of the mighty men? We sang that song, Rise Up, O Men of God. I hope that didn't offend anyone's gender sensibilities today. Yeah. You know, 1 Corinthians, Paul says, you know, be men. Act like men. The idea is men, women, like we've got work to do. And so we need to be strong and do it. We'll stop there, and next week, Lord willing, we'll look at chapter 24. Short little chapter, but there's some challenging things in it, so we'll be looking at 2 Samuel 24. Let's close with a prayer. And Brother McCollum, would you lead us in closing prayer?